Hi everyone, Drew Perot here, host of the Broken Brain Podcast. In today's episode, we have another interview in our behind-the-scenes series with my friend, Ara Katz, a serial entrepreneur who's worked at the intersection of tech, media, and consumer brands. She's also the co-founder and co-CEO of Seed Health, a microbial sciences company pioneering the application of bacteria to impact human and planetary health. In this interview, Ara talks to us about the greatest lessons she's learned in her experiences as an entrepreneur and co-founder, as well as the importance of finding the right business partner and nurturing that relationship to create something that actually has the ability to impact thousands, if not millions, of lives. Ara talks about what her experience as an entrepreneur taught her about self-care and how her own journey of having a miscarriage helped her to realign her focus to do something that had a great meaning and purpose. She also talks about what steps you need to take if you're looking to conduct your own study or clinical research in a company that you might found one day, and as well, the importance of integrity when it comes to marketing your business or product. We also dive deep into the topic of probiotics and how not all probiotics are created equal, as well as the common misconception that probiotics have to colonize your gut or alter the composition of your microbiome to be effective, which he says is not true. Ara is going to blow your mind when it comes to this topic of probiotics and creating a company and how we can think about self-care. I hope you enjoy this podcast in this behind-the-scenes series. Stay tuned for the interview. Welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast, where we dive deep into the topics of neuroplasticity, epigenetics, mindfulness, functional medicine, and mindset. I'm your host, Drew Perot, and each week my team and I bring on a new guest who we think can help you improve your brain health, feel better, and most importantly, live more. My guest this week is Ara Katz, and she's joining us for our Behind the Scenes series, where we chat with changemakers, entrepreneurs, and founders in the health and wellness world. Now, before we jump into our conversation with Ara, a little background on her. Ara is the co-founder and co-CEO of Seed Health, a microbial sciences company pioneering the application of bacteria to impact human and planetary health. She's a serial entrepreneur who's worked at the intersection of tech, media, and consumer brands. She's co-founded mobile commerce company Spring and advises and invests in companies like MindBodyGreen and healthcare startup Mommy. She was a fellow at the MIT Media Lab and named in Marie Claire's New Guard the 50 most influential women in the United States. Ara, welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited.
Well, before we jump into it and your story and everything there, I'd love to give a little bit of lay of the land. So just right now, before we go back into everything that you've been up to, give us a little bit more information about your current venture, Seed. What is it and what do you guys do?
Sure. So as you said, we're a microbial sciences company, which in English just means we work in microbes, mostly bacteria, and look at the ways that we can apply them to improve or impact human or environmental health. In human health, we look at how microbes and bacteria can impact really pervasive conditions for which there's very big unmet medical needs, for which there's no primary standard of care, or where a microbe might replace a primary standard of care. For example, like urinary tract infection.
Yeah.
50% of women in the world get urinary tract infection. Recurrence is a huge problem. It has other kind of downstream impacts to health. For women, currently fluoroquinolones, which is the class of antibiotics that are typically prescribed for women, and I'm sure a lot of women in the audience, like when you listen to this, they're like kind of like nod their head because they get on these kind of like they basically take for years in a row, they have to take these cycles
of antibiotics.
And what's happening is that because of antibiotic resistance, the fluoroquinolones, the antibiotics are no longer working. And so there's literally no other standard of care that is actively advised by the medical or scientific community or the FDA. And actually the FDA actively advises against antibiotics because they are aware of the resistance. And so it's a great example of where a microbe will likely be passed as a drug through our work to address something like urinary tract infection. So we work, also important to note, we work in consumer innovations, kind of like the next generation of what most people today know as probiotics, and also live biotherapeutics, which is essentially a probiotic that goes through drug trials. And then our environmental division, we work in areas, again, where we look at these big problems, something like honeybee where colony collapse disorder or American foulbrood disease is really reducing honeybee populations. So we have a probiotic for honeybees. Actually, a Nature paper came out last week about it. Areas like bioplastics or like plastic degradation where microbes can really help solve some of these really big problems.
It's great. It's a lot for a new company.
Yeah. Well, we have a really cool model because we have a foundry model, and we co-found these entities with the scientists that are doing this breakthrough research, and we really work and we come in at a stage where the research is really ready to kind of be translated, or where we can build on the research or go into kind of human clinical work if it's for humans, if it's for environmental work, where we can kind of amplify and accelerate a lot of the research and the application of it.
Yeah, because you were saying in the case of like UTIs, mm-hmm. and the current practice of just these antibiotics that women mm-hmm. are given ongoing, even though we know it's not the best way to go about it, there's plenty of research that's out there that's showing a different way of making it happen and mm-hmm. being able to support women with less side effects, mm-hmm. less creation of antibiotic resistant bacteria mm-hmm. that are there. And that's going to improve their overall health, but somebody's got to create it and somebody's got to take it to market.
Yeah, and this is not something that you can ferment in your kitchen. the work that, you know, the research that underlies like our urinary tract infection drug, you know, it's 15 years of development from like NIH and Gates Foundation funded research that takes incredibly long periods of time to assemble these data sets to obviously develop the technology to really understand like what are the microbes that we need to apply, what are these, you know, what is like in vaginal microbiome, obviously, like until our co-founder in that entity, Jacques Gravel, came along, like there really wasn't anyone doing that work. And I think we're very excited that like in each of the verticals we're in and where we're developing products or drugs or other applications for environmental problems, we are working with some of the top scientists in the field. And I think we're very excited by kind of what our pipeline looks like, which I can talk more about as we go along.
Yeah.
The other thing too, just to speak to what you said about, you know, how these alternative methodologies, like the cool thing, the other part of what we do under our consumer innovations brand, which is probably how you best know us, which is Seed, is that we really, as a brand, are so committed to the translation of science and how we can use the microbiome and this kind of 50% of ourselves to really shift perspective of the way we think of the choices we make every day, how we eat, whether or not to take an ibuprofen, how to think about the way we kind of care for ourselves. And we try and do that using kind of this new lens of the microbiome, and not just like the gut microbiome, but the skin microbiome, the vaginal microbiome, different, the oral microbiome. So a lot of what we do is thinking about how we also use content and the brand itself, not just to commercialize our probiotics, for example, but also to really like shift perspective.
What was life like before Seed? What were you up to?
Oh man, well, I've spent my whole career telling stories. First in more traditional ways, like as a filmmaker and as a producer, and you know, early days of like the interweb when like short form and like kind of all kinds of new formats for storytelling were kind of coming about. And then I realized that like there's applications for being able to tell a story in other worlds. And so I used to consult for lots of big companies, even the Department of Defense, like thinking about how storytelling can communicate and make change and make impact. And then I realized like that also had application in the startup world. And so I joined my first commerce company in 2010 on the founding team with the guys who had started MySpace, and they were kind of thinking about like, where is e-commerce going to go? And I ended up in like a series of startups where always it was like that storytelling lens that was like allowed me to realize that you could create community. You could make change. I've consulted and worked on a lot of like nonprofit campaigns
and was that a big leap? Sorry to interject.
Yeah, but no,
was that a big leap for you to mm-hmm. go from sort of the world of storytelling mm-hmm. into entrepreneurship?
Honestly, I was an independent. I've been hustling since I was like in fifth grade. So like it really wasn't, because I think I was even in film, I was an independent filmmaker. I was running a film fund. I think from a very early age, I found out that I had a skill set that could connect disparate dots and create value. And in which a lot of people just call hustling. And I think that I've always had that entrepreneurial spirit. I think, and even like, I was like, even in college, I taught myself HTML. I was like, early, I taught myself graphic design. I was always like, I was making websites like in high school. So like, I've always had the tech bug. But also I always saw the synergies between like disparate industries too. So like at the Media Lab, for example, when I was even in traditional, like more traditional filmmaking, that was where I got to think, I helped start a group there called the Future of, the Center for Future of Storytelling. And that was, well, what is story going to look like in a world where we're just communicating with screens a lot, like the UI, you know, we're looking at the UI and UX of just these different technologies are going to be major parts of our lives in the coming years. And that was even before the iPhone. And so I think I always had like the tech bug. I just hadn't been like actually like, I'd consulted to a lot of tech companies, and because I kind of had taught myself HTML early, and like, so just kind of had always stayed up with that. And then the Media Lab obviously just kind of like really inspired and ignited a feeling that like, oh, I really kind of want to be in that world full time.
So for a lot of entrepreneurs, their origin story in terms of their creation, especially in the health and wellness, comes from just their lives. Yes. So let's take us to where you were, where you joined this company.
Yes.
And one of the things that you've been pretty public about in sharing in different interviews and things is just the crazy lifestyle that you had, intense work that was going on at the time. So take us to that part.
Sure.
And what was your relationship with health and wellness back then?
Yeah, it's a so it's actually interesting. I can take you like, I won't take you all the way through, but just like to time leap for a second. My mom died when I was 17 from pancreatic cancer. And for anyone who's kind of witnessed like a stage 4 cancer like that, that really has like, especially at the time, a really poor prognosis, I literally watched my mom go from like a healthy human in like 361 days decline and die. And it is an extraordinarily like impressionable experience when you really at a young age understand what it means to not have health and to not be healthy and to watch what happens to the body, like aesthetically, visual, like it's I think like when you grow up, your grandparents are like, oh, at least you have your health, and you know, you're young, you kind of have like a biological arrogance of like, oh, I don't know what that means. And unless you really like hurt yourself or you get sick in some
when
way,
you're
like
young, you think you're invincible, you're gonna live forever.
And you don't, but I think when I think ever since then, like I have always had like an acute awareness of that, like this is all we get. And like the idea that people wake up every day and make choices that like impact the ability for our like physical machinery to not allow us to reach our full potential or do what we want to do or be with loved ones or really just like use our bodies to create or do whatever we do every day. Has always been something that fascinated me. And that led me to in certainly like a lot of curiosity around like biology and physiology. And so somehow over the years, I became the person that everybody texts and asks, I'm sure like in the context of sitting in like a room with like a Mark, for example, that would be like kind of funny because I don't have a degree and certainly nowhere near as qualified, but I somehow became the person that was just good at researching.
Because you were saying even back then you were looking things up on like PubMed and articles and other things, just trying to see if you could be of support for your mom and look at the different things that she was going through.
Yeah. And that was like part of the clinical kind of seeking out clinical trials. And I grew up with an acute awareness of nutrition because ironically, my mom was really obsessed with nutrition. I was not allowed junk food. And, you know, and so it's of course ironic that she got so sick at such a young age. Jump to what you were talking about was really like my journey working in a number of startups. And, I think like, you know, at certain moments in your life, And I think a lot of like when you're younger, a lot of your identity is really like wrapped up. Sometimes, at least for me, it was in work and like what you do. And so I always was like a yogi and I was always the person that was incredibly mindful of diet and like what I put in my body. And actually really, as I mentioned, was always the person that people would come to. And I was never working and like not going to the yoga class or to the point where like I didn't take care of myself. But I think the part of me that was fun, that's like very surfacey stuff when you're fundamentally not taking care of yourself in the choices that you make every
day.
Like,
what does that look like? Sleep? What does that look like? Stress?
I think it looks like a kind of blind busyness that like is and like a kind of a frenetic way of working and defining your value and believing that like your derivation of like meaning and happiness and what you want out of life will come from like working more.
And the external attachments to the highs and lows of that.
Yeah. And I have to, and what I have actually come to, because I think it's very easy to just be like, oh, you like, it's very easy to tell the story. And the Instagram version is like, I was just super stressed. And, but the truth is that, and actually what I found, and my husband, if he was sitting here in the room, would like laugh to like at the idea that I've somehow changed in that way. Because what I've learned is that I actually love creating, and it is my, I do work a lot, and that has actually not changed. So I don't want to like the superficial world is like, oh, now I take so much more time to do, but I actually do work probably almost just as much, but it's the quality.
To that point in time in your life where we're kind of like reflecting more, you had that company and those experiences.
That was where I think it's a lot more about like, well, what am I creating every day? So like when you work that much, but you feel out of alignment with what you're creating, when you maybe feel out of alignment with whom you're creating it with, if you feel out of alignment with, well, why am I working this hard for something that, like, I don't know if like the world needs. And so I think there was like, I think that's what was actually like most difficult for me. And
like
then
a soul level.
Yeah. On like on a real soul level, on like a, you kind of like, I think what you're pointing to or kind of getting at was that I had a miscarriage and I was like also commuting from New York to LA and just making like poor life choices that I don't know, like reflect like a deep thinking about like, what do you want for your life? What do you want to create? Where do you want to, what do you want to invest in? And I think like when you're commuting from New York to LA to build like basically what it was a shopping app, like, yes, there's very cool aspects to it. I'm very proud of the work we did. And like, there's some really tech innovation there. And so I don't want to be like overly reductive, but you know, you just kind of like at a certain moment, like in my miscarriage was certainly that moment, like it kind of just wakes you up and like you kind of almost like it was like a beautiful like just zooming out of my life and kind of looking at it from like the outside and saying like, well, this just isn't viable. Working this hard for something that is maybe not making impact or change, at least for my value set, doing it in a way that takes me away constantly from the person I'm building a life with, working the hours that I do, without maybe the fulfillment in, for so many things around that company that like, I think that was where it was like the wake up call.
So, I mean, in real life, like you said, like taking out of the Instagram, you know, summary of the situation. Yes. With limited characters that you can write a story about.
Yes.
How long before that translated into like, okay, I do like working. Mm-hmm. I do want to create. I am good at this stuff. I am passionate about these areas of my life, including health. How long before that took into the next creation, the next project?
I always like to say, like, I think everything has always been creating itself. It's just a matter of when it like expresses. And so I got pregnant very shortly after that. And actually, interestingly enough, and a lot of women say this, when I was pregnant, you definitely think you want to start like 10 businesses. You're just like creating, like you're just like there's, and I don't think so. I don't think the creating ever necessarily stopped, but in terms of where I wanted to put all my energy next, I was pregnant. I got introduced to my co-founder Raja when I was pregnant. And I think it was more actually not the creating of what Seed is as much as it was the creating of our co-foundership and our relationship and the deep investment in getting to know each other and align that was really ultimately what led us to creating Seed. And I think a lot of, actually I was introduced to him when he was about to launch a consumer brand for his previous company. So I was introduced to him as like an advisor, you know, as a potential advisor to their company. And so we just spent so much time investing in the relationship, and that ultimately, I mean, we founder dated for like much longer than that typically happens.
So for anybody who's ever thought about having a business or definitely for people who have had a business, finding the right founder in a company is like, it's not exactly marriage, but it's a version of that. You're going to be spending so much time together. You're going to be creating stuff. There's being in a soul alignment, especially when you're building a health and wellness company where you're trying to reflect that in. What were the questions you were asking yourself at that process? And were you looking for a co-founder?
I was having a baby and like had just left the company, and I was still transitioning out of my previous company because I had a really long transition out and I really wanted to do right by my partners. And there was a lot of kind of unfinished business and stuff that I wanted, that I could handle from kind of across the country. I was not looking for it. I think I knew that I would create like a new business eventually. I certainly didn't think it would happen that quickly, particularly like it's not the first thing on your mind, like when you're pregnant, to start something. I think the questions, well, a few things. I mean, a lot of the way you get to know somebody, right, is sometimes it's just so subtle. Like it's not so much the overt questions as much as it's like you spend enough time with people, you see these like, you know, the very like the nuances of how they listen to you when you're talking about things that have nothing to do with that. The, you know, the way they talk to the waiter. I mean, these are things that you learn a lot about humans, I think sometimes in just like having a tea and talking about something entirely different, because I got to fundamentally understand the way and what I was most excited and inspired by with Raja was the way that he translates science and not just from like a product perspective or a research and development perspective, but the way we actually got to talk about how science can be translated into the way you make decisions every day. And when I was pregnant, that was incredibly important, because having that kind of myth busting, and particularly when the world knows you're pregnant and the algorithms know you're pregnant, you're getting served all this information. And while I was always already that kind of researcher, I think Raja's obviously depth of knowledge and ability to synthesize that stuff was like of course, a whole nother level than mine.
And was the focus microbes at the time? Did you both know that you kind of wanted to go down?
The focus was early life development. At the time, because I was growing a human, it was early life development. That's where we kind of like bonded. Raja used to make me my prenatal packs and drop them off like a drug dealer to my house, because he understood like the exact dosing, and he literally custom made me these things while I was pregnant. And so we got to know each other a lot through that. Microbes came about a little bit more because he really realized that that's where he wanted to focus kind of academically and intellectually and clinically. And it came about for me more because of how much I was starting to understand like the importance of both my microbiome and the microbiome that I was going to be cultivating once my child was born. So really through my lens of like becoming a mother. And then about a few months after I had my son, I could only supply about a third of his breast milk. And that was when you think about supplement, like looking for supplementation was kind of like our aha moment of, I can't believe, given what we understand about an infant's developing microbiome today, that these are the supplementation options available to somebody who could really kind of, because I could afford spending a little bit more on some of the ones where all the women are, you know, a lot of, I think wealthier women are like, get this stuff from Europe and when you really start to scientifically look at those, I mean, there was nothing that really answered the question of like, well, what is my child not getting from a microbe, like from a cultivation of like his microbiome in the supplementation? And there wasn't a lot of great answers at that time. Now there's a lot more formulas now that are available that kind of contemplate, at least, or say they contemplate that. And that reinventing infant formula was what was our inception point. And then from there, we realized as we started to develop that and really look at early life development, we realized that we had really cracked something in a model of how we could collaborate and partner with scientists in the field amongst a number of verticals
are going to be impactful. And who was one of the first scientists that you guys decided to partner with, and how did you come about to discovering that research and then ultimately coming out with the first product?
So Raja had connected very early with Dr. Gregor Reed, who was the chair of ISAP, which is the International Society of Probiotics and Prebiotics. He was the scientist who had chaired the panel for the WHO and the UN to actually create and write the scientific definition of what a probiotic is, which is the only scientifically accepted definition in the world that's used kind of in literature. And has been very well adopted by the scientific community. And so he's probably the most robust researcher specifically on probiotic science. So the idea of like looking at microbes that have an impact and specific strains that have a specific impact in the human host. And there was no question that if you're looking to, in the field, particularly of consumer probiotics and where we wanted to innovate, that he was probably, there was no one else that had, I mean, he has more papers than any other scientist in the field in the world.
And how do you approach a scientist, you know, to say like, this is a, we need to take, because there's often fear
yes.
in academics
Correct.
Of being associated. Yep. They want their work to translate and make a difference, but mm-hmm. they want to keep distance between them and that. So does this mean like he's actually like a financial partner inside the company? And how do you approach yes, somebody sure. to even want to do it with all that great research that can be translated into products?
So there's a few things that we look for outside of just like the quality of the science and our scientists. And one of which is like an incredible like humanistic drive, which is scientists that know they can earn a lot of accolades in academia, but who maybe aren't motivated by how they can impact human health at scale are not for us. And so Gregor, like you just have to, I mean, he's a boisterous, Scottish man with a passion for like impacting health in a way that like I truly is incredibly unique. His work, he also, his North Star is like the relief of suffering and the improvement of health and way beyond like first world problems or like great probiotics for the Western world. I mean, he works in Africa. He created a program in Africa called Yogurt Mamas for women with HIV that not only in fermenting the specific strains that they can drink, not only increase their CD4 counts, that ultimately made their HIV medication more impactful. Like there's like, I mean, not only that, it also created sustainable businesses for them to sell these beverages, to their local community. So he's like, he's an extraordinary human being. And I think that was something that like he felt and has felt for a long time. He has not ever put his name on a company in that way. He has a strain that he discovered years ago that is used in industry quite a bit, but he himself had not started a company. And so
he was like the archetype of someone that you're looking to
absolutely. To work with. And so I think he knows how limiting academia can be if you want to be able to impact people at scale. And I think he felt that we were approaching this unlike most of the industry that has approached him over the years, for which he's been offered many contracts and opportunities, that we were approaching this with a kind of integrity and an adherence to scientific rigor that he had not seen. At the same time, I think he equally felt humanistically aligned with where we what was most important to us. And so he, it was kind of just, we were just incredible alignment.
And just like on a practical level, because I think for folks mm-hmm. that are listening, you know, with 2 years, one to like learn about
yes.
seed and probiotics and like, you mm-hmm. know, the approach you guys take, but also there's creators out there that mm-hmm. are listening, people who want to start a company yes. one day, people that want to do something or are already doing something. Mm-hmm. When it came to, I think you said your co-founder had met him once yes. previously.
Yeah.
When it came to even setting up an initial meeting mm-hmm. and that, what does it look like? Just emailing this,
I mean, the academic, scientist? You know, I mean, kind of not dissimilar to a lot of industries, I mean, and areas of research or of areas of industry and also areas like where people kind of commune at conferences. Like a lot happens in like building up and kind of seeing people over and over again at like in particularly
FaceTime,
in like
that FaceTime.
Yeah. And so I think they had Raja and Gregor had built a really nice rapport, and I think Gregor started to be like, who is this kid? Who is this guy? Like, what, he's crazy, but also so intelligent and going about this in the way that kind of like I wish more companies did. And so I think they certainly immediately locked in around those things from a just logistical perspective. So a lot of academic people who are employed by academia or whose labs or research is funded in academia, there are some restraints about how they can be paid. And so of course, like it is kind of nuanced and specific to each person and to each academic and to each scientist or researcher. But for the most part, it's not dissimilar to you pay them and you give them some equity.
Yeah.
it's kind of not harder than that. I think, and then there's some other things, just to stay on logistics. Like if you're going to use their academic labs or you're going to work with any of their PhDs, sometimes there's additional like ways of structuring things. You know, particularly if they're going to do any bench work for you, if they're going to, be principals, investigators on clinical trials,
if they're going to publish IP. If some of the studies of their work have been done by like a university mm-hmm. or like a group.
Yes.
you know, I'm sure it depends, but does that group also get a royalty as part of the process?
Yeah, I mean, so what you're referring to is what you call, those are like the tech transfer offices. And so every academic institution has a tech transfer office, and that is specifically their job is to figure out how they can commercialize and extract value out of the work that's being done. And so there usually it's some combination of upfront payments or milestone-based payments, along with some sort of royalties, is the typical structure.
And do you guys do that too, or do you look for a different type of structure?
Honestly, we have such a deep pipeline that everything is pretty
different.
It's a little. There's nuances, but that's a good framework. It's fairly similar framework across the board. The difference being that in our foundry model, we co-found the company with the scientists, and therefore they also have equity, which if I was just like a pharmaceutical company coming to Harvard to license IP, that's not what happens.
So I want to go back to co-founder.
Yes.
When you were looking at a person, you were developing this mm-hmm. time with your current co-founder, on a practical level, what did you feel like you were best at, and what you feel like you're co-founder is best at when it came to co-founding Seed?
Well, I mean, very like tactically, I could not run our research and development. I don't have like the scientific expertise. But once you get past the just like basic, I guess, obvious differences in like our experience around like he kind of stewards like the R&D and product development, and I kind of oversee like the commercialization, the fundraising, and like the brand and the storytelling. We overlap a lot on like ops and finance stuff. And then of course, those two worlds, I think that what we believe is our magic is of course, those two worlds dance very intimately together, particularly like storytelling and the translation of science and what we're doing on the science side. That being said, they're owned very separately. In terms of what as humans we're good at and not good at, you know, like I think we both knew Raja is, well, he's actually a trained debater, and he was like a national debater, went on a full scholarship to USC. And so he has a very like debate style to the way he communicates, which I had to get really used to because I'm like, is he mad at me? Like, is he mad at me? And like over time I realized, no, actually he can actually vehemently defend both sides, like debate both sides of something as a means to get to like what the right answer is.
But that's so important, communication styles and being
so I had to like learn. So like I think the very first thing was that we started from this place of just kind of like a radical transparency. And like, I was incredibly open and upfront with him about where I wouldn't say I believe I'm not good at something, but where I really choose not to spend my time, and where I think that if I shouldn't, it's not where I should spend my time around certain things around like operations. And I think he and I have similar kind of like self-awareness, not like that we couldn't do it, but that we're probably not the best person to do it. In terms of qualities, I mean, he met me when I was pregnant. And so I think I needed to find someone that was going to be incredibly understanding and empathic to the fact that like my life is in a different place than his life is. And this is really important I don't think this gets talked about enough, which is that I couldn't just get like, you know, like I think a lot of co-founders think everything has to be like done equally and therefore you're in a relationship that is healthy. Whereas like the truth is, if you looked at the times that Raja had to come to my house or had to work around my schedule with my son, or it's absolutely 1000% lopsided, like 100% lopsided. Like he has had to bend his schedule to work around and not in some like deferential way, but like just in the way that's like, you know, this is what your life is right now. And for us to do things, and like, I'm not married and I, like have kind of unlimited time and I don't have any dependents. And so it's easy. Yeah.
Quick question on that. Just interject.
Yeah.
I think this is important, it's important for men and women, but especially for a lot of the women that are listening, either have a company or don't have a company, mm-hmm. maybe have had a kid or want to have a kid one day.
Yes.
Did you ever have a complex of that? Like, it sounds like he was pretty accommodating and was willing to do that. Did you ever have an internal complex of like feeling bad asking mm-hmm. for it or any challenges?
You know, I think that like so much of this partnership and relationship was very first principles around like, I wanted to really undo a lot of the wiring that certainly didn't like serve me before. And So there's just realities to like when you're breastfeeding, like you need to be near your breast pump or you need to be near like your human that you're feeding. So like there in some ways, like it just kind of started that way because there were like biological realities to like what I was dealing with. I think I do. Yeah. I think once in a while, I sometimes feel that he has to be a little more flexible than I do. But I also believe that we so clearly add value in such meaningful ways that we never get into that narrative of like, well, you did this. And investors always ask us like, do you guys step on each other's toes? And I'm like, we always answer like our toes aren't even in the same house. Like we, because of how clearly like our divide and conquer is. And then in the worlds where there's like a little bit of overlap, we have such clear methodologies for like, you're going to take the first draft of this, I'll set up the call. Like we don't, there hasn't been any messiness like ever in almost 4 years.
So one more question on the co-founders before we continue on. What advice would you have for, I mean, so many more people are into entrepreneurship now than ever before. It seems like, you know, that's definitely grown.
It's the cool thing.
And I always get a little nervous when people tell me, whether they're in health and wellness or not, it's like, I have somebody that I want to work with. We're going to co-found this company 50-50. Yes. We're in. And they've never worked together. What advice do you have for entrepreneurs?
Oh, man. I mean, there's really no substitute for time. Like, you know, you can work with a coach. You can. I mean, there's so many. I think that it is like an unblinking, eyes wide open, immediate space that needs to be cultivated between the two people that not one thing could come up that you don't have an agreed upon way that you work through and talk about this stuff, and that you really dig into what does it feel like to get a Slack from you? What does it feel like to get an email from you? How will you handle this, this, and this? What do you look like on your worst day? I don't care what you look like on your best day, because that's like great. But like, what does stress look like to you? What do you look like on your worst day? What is your family situation? Like, do you sit on your phone in meetings? Are you going to text your girlfriend the whole time that we're talking? Like, I think we sometimes like separate work and like life in like these very odd ways that like don't make any sense to me, just because I'm like, I'm just a human that happens to like go into different spaces. But we have this like very interesting like splitting that we do, like work and life, where it's like, it's just kind of all life. And so I think the idea that, you know, I think Maya Angelou has that beautiful line, like when someone tells you who they are, believe them. And so the only way I think that you can have someone tell you who they are is like, you can ask a lot of the meaningful questions, and hearing how self-aware someone is and if they've really done work to like be able to articulate is one way. But there's no substitute for just the amount of time that someone needs to show you how they show up and how you show up to them, which, by the way, may not be good or bad. It just may not be a fit for you.
Right.
And so I think,
for the company that you guys want to create.
So much of this stuff is, well, what's the work that you've done in your life? Like, I mean, how good are you at choosing the humans that you want to do life with? I don't think this is fundamentally any different. I think one of the things that happens in human relationships, and Raj and I think have this like really nailed down, is if there's any space for stories to start, they will metastasize to many other things, both in your relationship and in the company. And if you are really truly going to, and also co-founding is different than co-CEOing and co-leading too. So I would articulate that like some people, Raj and I chose to co-CEO together, which I think in some ways is a little bit more challenging than you can co-found something, but then like what really is your role? So just acknowledging you were there from the beginning and together at the beginning, and that this was like something you want to put out in the world together. Then some people take CTO and then like CEO. And then I think like there's a lot of clarity that comes from that. Whereas when you start to co-found and co-CEO, I think that's where I've seen things get a little murkier.
Let's pivot back over to product and your first product that Seed put out.
Sure.
When you were coming into and you're in product development and putting the product together, and you were also at a place where you were talking about the algorithms and getting bombarded by a lot of like health information and not knowing, is it true? Is it not true? And having this co-founder who's so deep in the research, What were some of the myths that were being busted on your end
sure.
as you were in the process of product development mm-hmm. and creating this first product, this probiotic?
Yeah, it's an interesting, it's a great question, because I think then you kind of have to separate the two, because I don't want it to seem like our R&D or research is driven by the need to like bust myths about other, like, you know, we're not like a we, you asked, we listened kind of brand around products. That's not really like in our minds how science works or how we're going to make the greatest kind of impact. Of course, other parts of the brand where we are incredibly engaged and, more interactive that way. Around the product itself, I think, you know, when you talk to someone like Gregor, he actually wrote a beautiful paper yesterday that I'll send you, where you talk about like the steward, like we wanted to be the steward of like really where the future of probiotics could go. And when you think about where microbes are going to go, and you think about like one of the, there's a number of myths that you have to kind of like work against, specifically because of the term probiotic in the US, unlike in the EU, is unregulated. Hence why we have probiotic chocolate, probiotic beverages, probiotic pillows, probiotic cleaning, like all of these things that are kind of claiming to be a probiotic without having to kind of adhere to that scientific definition I mentioned earlier. So one of the things we certainly wanted to do is make sure, obviously, that like the microbes we were working with, the bacterial strains and probiotic strains, and it's important to say strained because most products, many products on the market today actually just say the species, which is like saying I have a dog and not knowing if it's a lab or a French bulldog. So it's, you know, the specificity of the strains is incredibly important. And so we knew we needed to be working with and or conducting the clinical work on strains that had demonstrated and, you know,
just published. Could you give an example? Because sure. I don't think everybody is familiar with strains.
Yes.
And I think
sure.
there is a lot of, so like, let's say somebody's going yes. into Whole Foods mm-hmm. and they're picking up just
yes.
probiotic, one of the top brand names that's yep. on there. They're looking at the back of the label.
Yep.
What is a strain? What's a species? Yeah. Like, what are they looking for? And can
sure.
you give some examples?
Absolutely. So like you may have seen, and actually I'll say this, but truthfully, like in 6 months, if someone's watching this, the whole taxonomic structure of the genera and the species and the strains are going to change. So lactobacilli, which I think lactobacillus, a lot of people have kind of like heard about as a genera, like that is actually now going to, I think in the next, you know, 6 months to a year, are going to be now be broken out into different ones, and the whole taxonomic like naming system
and who decides
is about
that?
To change. There's a number of like kind of scientific bodies that are like working on it. A lot of people in mostly like scientists in the microbiology space who kind of like convene and are in different panels, kind of like how the probiotic definition got defined, that then make these decisions about like how, because now we're at a point, particularly the more we've like learned about this world, we're realizing that the taxonomic structure kind of needs to now accommodate like where the science is going. So I'll say what I'll say today, and it's probably true for at least another year, but it is actually changing. So you have something like, you look at like, a lot of times it just says L dot, which means like lactobacilli, for example. And then it will say like Plantarum as a good example. And then after that, if you don't see like a number or a series of letters, it kind of just means that they're telling you the species. But if you see kind of numbers after it, like that's where you kind of know there's like strain specificity. And that's usually like either an identifier, that's like how the strain was actually banked. There's a number of strain banks around the world, or how the company itself named it in like the clinical work, for example. We try and adhere to the naming structure that's referenceable in like the literature, because all the strains that we work with are in clinical trials that are, you know, published.
Because most people would look at those strains and say, well, if there's not any supporting literature on the bottle, like, mm-hmm. I don't know what that means.
Yeah. But I mean, most people would look at the literature and still not know what it means, you know, not
right,
know what
right.
it means.
So, this audience,
you know,
may be a little bit in between.
Maybe, sure.
But
absolutely.
I would, but yes.
Yeah. I mean,
so what's nice
public,
about it is,
yeah.
is the fact that you guys reference the full amount mm-hmm. so that people can look it up and
yes.
say, because one of the things that you've been sharing, you and Raja and through Seed, is that just because a strain has shown certain evidence or information in a clinical trial doesn't mean that that's actually going to be what you need in that moment.
Yeah. And I think there's a few other, just to go back to like the kind of wrap it into the myth busting conversation, like the, you know, and there's also more specificity that goes into it. So all of our studies are referenceable, like on our website. A lot of companies don't necessarily do that. especially if they're at this, or if they're at the species level, they'll just list like every trial that, or study that's been done on the species, which is like, again, it's like saying I studied dogs and not studying like which ones you studied. And so like, there's a lot of other specificity, which is, well, what was the dosage that was used in the clinical trials that you're claiming? Are you preserving the dosage? Are you preserving the biofermentation conditions, the pH, the medium? That like there's so many nuances, particularly when it comes to microbes, that is very different than like many other categories and like kind of supplements that we preserve from the clinical work. And in most cases, in our supply chain, we're working with we're working with whomever manufactured it for that specific clinical trial too. And so that's like, of course, like kind of not a typical thing in our, you know, in the larger category of probiotics. And so dosage is a really big one, and that's a big loophole. Most probiotics, you also don't know what dosage they're in the capsule present in. And then in addition to that, they are very often not preserving the dosage from the clinical work that they're claiming the benefit for. And then further to that, they're often using a very crude way of measuring viability, which you've probably seen on the bottle, which is CFU. So colony forming units, everyone thinks like 50 billion, you know, must be amazing. And so
the more the better.
The more the better. And you know, maybe it depends on like which strain. Usually people just put the more of the strain that's the cheapest, and less of the strain that's probably the more expensive, versus like looking at kind of how you're preserving the dosages. We work with a different metric called AFU, which you have to use kind of flow cytometry for, to be able to really identify what are the active bacteria, which is, and the ones that are viable, which is a little bit different than CFU. So our numbers, well, at CFU would be a lot higher, but AFU is a more precise way of doing it. And then I'd say the last piece, which is the delivery technology, which is, well, how are you actually getting them to where, and that is another myth, just to bring it back to your myth question, which is you see a lot of companies be like, gets it to where it needs to go, or survivability, but really they're not using some of the more sophisticated technologies to demonstrate how do you know that this many viable organisms are making it to the colon.
Because of digestion and other
factors. Yeah, and so there are
stomach acids.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So so there's a lot of die-off that can happen in digestion. And so then you have to start looking at like, well, what are the technologies we can use to be able to understand how these things behave in the body? And then those same technologies are often the same methodology that you use to like understand like how also this product would be stable under heat, like really bad heat conditions, for example, which is kind of the way we use the technologies.
And just even zooming out bigger picture, you know, you were talking about like probiotics is unregulated.
Yes.
You know, even something like, you know, you guys talk about like kombucha is not really a probiotic.
Mm-hmm.
Can
yeah.
you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes. Although I'm sure you'll get a lot of, we're not always the most popular people at the wellness conference as a result of saying things like that. And it really is, just to clarify it, because it sounds like such a little bit of a negative statement. It doesn't mean that some of these things don't have other, like the benefits of some of these, like something like, well, kombucha is one, but like kimchi or fermented foods, it's not to say that they don't have other benefits in the body. I haven't seen them studied, so I obviously open to kind of like learning more about that from any companies that are doing studies or people in industry that are doing studies. But all we mean is that under the scientific definition, you don't know what the dose is. Most of the strains that are really good at fermentation are not necessarily the strains that are good at creating a desired impact in a human host, nor have they been measured to do so, nor do you know if they're in any of the correct amounts to be able to even have that effect. And then lastly, I would say it's pretty hard to understand how, like without an ongoing like nutrient source, how would they stay alive and viable both on the shelf for 3, 4, 5, 6 months, but then also through the body. And so those are the questions that I think we kind of have. There's a couple of Harvard PhDs we had met along our journey who had like gone to Whole Foods and sequenced every single bacteria in all the kimchis and all the kombuchas on the shelf, and they couldn't find one that had any kind of probiotic effect in like a C. elegans model.
It's crazy.
But just to be clear, it doesn't mean that there might be other benefits from those. It's just not necessarily adheres to the definition of scientifically qualifying to say it has a probiotic effect in the body.
So you've also said there's a common misconception that probiotics have to colonize your gut and mm-hmm. alter the composition of your microbiome to yes. be effective.
Yeah, and this is one where I truly wish it didn't work this way, because it would make our life so much easier if we could just say, you're missing this, put this back. It's just not how microbes work. We work with what you would call non-colonizing bacteria, which are what they call, like, I guess in science, more transient microbes, which simply means they do their work on the road. So as they're moving through your GI system, they're signaling to both microbes and human cells, and their kind of impact happens as they move through the body, versus the idea that they kind of like you take almost like a garden, like where you like take them and then like you somehow could take a test and it would tell you what you're missing, and then you just ingest that bacteria and like magically like that's what's now repopulated, which again, I truly wish that that's how it worked, because from a marketing and storytelling perspective, that would be so much easier. But microbes really are, at least probiotics and the ones we work with, are transient.
And so how does that shift? Like if somebody's like taking probiotics that's out mm-hmm. there today mm-hmm. and they're trying to look at like the validity, and they have a million other things that are going on. They're sure. running their own business in the tech space. Sure. And they're trying to be a mom or sure. trying to do this. Mm-hmm. What are the resources and places that are out there that they can start to see, like, is the thing that I'm taking for real or not for real?
I mean, it depends what you're taking a microbe for. So if you're taking a microbe, for example, that might work on the gut skin axis that dampens like the inflammatory response that causes like, let's say, eczema, that is very, the answer is like, I don't know if you need a test as much as you could say like, well, my eczema is clearing up and I've dealt with eczema my whole life and now I can wear t-shirts. Like, you know, there's like some very clear visceral ways, and it really just depends. I only use that example to say that it really depends on the specificity of what you're looking for and why you're taking it. There's microbes that have been, from a GI health perspective, studied to increase regularity or have a homeostatic effect on like stool regularity. So if you go too much, it kind of makes you go in a more consistent way and less. And if you really were suffering from constipation or irregular stools, it kind of makes you go more regularly. And so there are microbes that really do have that homeostatic effect on digestion and induce regularity and stool and consistency. And so I imagine that like the quick way of measuring that is, am I going to the bathroom regularly? And I wasn't before. And so I think it just really, I mean, that's why we, I wish there was kind of like a global copy and paste answer to your question, but it's kind of like, well, if you're taking ibuprofen for your, acid reflux, like you're probably not going to see much of a benefit.
So let's go back to what products mm-hmm. you guys came out
sure.
with. Right. So the first product was a probiotic. Remind me of the name again.
It's a symbiotic. It's it's a combination of probiotics and prebiotics, which scientifically they call synbiotics.
And there's one for men and there's one for women?
Actually, it's unisex. Now we just actually literally it's now unisex because we have two trials starting, one at Harvard and one in Canada, one for IBS and population and one for antibiotic recovery. And so to be able to study the daily symbiotic in a heterogeneous population, and we filed our IND with the FDA to be able to study the symbiotic as an investigative new drug, which is what IND stands for. We had to use one formulation so we could study in both men and women.
So even though the formulas are mm-hmm. inspired by like the clinical yes. research that, you know, the co-founders, the yes. science co-founders mm-hmm. have, the academic yes. co-founders, now you're taking the final product mm-hmm. and you're going to put it through its own trial.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so how did you choose the first couple things that you wanted to study?
Sure. So so we have a number of other clinical trials that are also slated for this specific product and some other really interesting studies that are not in humans, but actually using some new technologies to actually like understand what the daily symbiotic is actually doing in the body and how it responds to things like, or how it interacts with like in the wake of like alcohol consumption or coffee or so in addition to our human clinical work, we're also working on some other studies using new technologies to understand how it behaves in the human GI system in response to information or I guess provocations like alcohol and sugar and things like that. So that's another aspect of our clinical work. The ones that you asked about, the ones that I mentioned earlier that you're asking about, it came about a number of things. I think one one is as a company, like we really are committed to moving science forward. And so there've been a lot of misunderstandings in the media and in how specific previous research has been communicated to the, I guess, at least in the mainstream media about whether or not probiotics are effective. And part of that is because there's very little specificity. In fact, we wrote a paper earlier this year with Gregor that was published in Frontiers in Microbiology that's simply titled, actually would be probably really interesting for your audience, called Probiotics, Reiterating What They Are and What They're Not. And so it was a real call, not just to like marketers and like the people who sell things in Whole Foods, probiotic tortilla chips, but it was actually a call to action even within the scientific community for remembering what that definition is and calling for that specificity. So for us, the clinical work around probiotics, even for things that are just consumer interventions, is incredibly important and a big part of our mission. The symbiotic specifically for antibiotic recovery actually comes out of really wanting to understand, you know, you may have heard of, I'm sure a lot of your audience has heard of, I think Mark's spoken about it quite a bit, about antibiotic induced dysbiosis. So like basically the collateral damage that antibiotics do in the gut, and then what specific strains of probiotics could do in that restoration or reparation after that collateral damage, and like what is the impact they could have. And so that's the first one, which I think is incredibly important, particularly in the wake of, I think we're just in a moment where antibiotics are of course, use is rampant. And you know, I think there's some crazy stat that like over 50% of antibiotic prescriptions in the US, of which there's about 70 million a year, are for things that are of non-bacterial origin. Which is crazy. And of course, now we're seeing antibiotic resistance, not just with UTI drugs, antibiotics, but across a whole host of drugs. And so that's, I mean, if there's a couple major threats to humanity, like the resistance of antibiotics is probably one of them. And superbugs, I'm sure, which you've heard of. And then the second actually is really, and this is a great actually example of kind of like you spoke, we listened, which is, completely anecdotally, since we've been, since people have been using our daily symbiotic, we overwhelmingly hear from people who have suffered from a number of chronic GI disorders and autoimmune conditions like Crohn's and ulcerative colitis, but overwhelmingly with IBS patients, we hear, and again, I want to continue to reiterate, this is anecdotal, which is why we're doing the study, and not something that we claim at all. But we do hear so much from our community and from other, from patients and people who suffer from IBS, that like the daily symbiotic has changed their life and has been the only thing, only intervention that has ever helped them. And so we're working with Dr. Anthony Lembo at Harvard Medical School to do our first IBS trial.
That's great. And you know, what's really exciting to see is there's more, as the standard of science is kept really high, and there's more people that are coming into the world of mm-hmm. entrepreneurship and health yes. community from different areas and fields, mm-hmm. including academics themselves. There's more and more companies that are making that commitment to like do studies right away when their product comes yes. out. Mm-hmm. We just had the founders of Juvelight, mm-hmm. the red light therapy, mm-hmm. and there's so many clinical trials out there on red light therapy and mm-hmm. infrared light therapy yes. and its advantages for skin and other areas. Mm-hmm. And they were just sharing that, you know, they, even with all that information that's out there and a mm-hmm. database that's on their website to go and search it, they're like, it's important for our final product to mm-hmm. us to show people mm-hmm. that they can know and they can trust it. It's almost like the worlds of wellness mm-hmm. and what traditionally would have been like hardcore, like pharmaceuticals are kind yes. of coming together. What for somebody who's thinking or has a vision for creating a product one day in mm-hmm. the future in the health space, what's important for them to know about like venturing into the world of studies and doing your own study on a product?
That it needs to be done in the gold standard of science, which is, you know, double blind placebo randomized controlled trials, which is kind of like the cornerstone, and that it should be registered and that it needs to be published for, I think, the scientific community to take it seriously. There's no shortage of companies that do clinical, I use air quotes, clinical trials and studies. The problem is that like it is now becoming, now that science is cool again, and every company in wellness is starting to claim science. And we see that more and more. One Google search can like show you that really, really quickly. I think it really is about, well, what is the scientific rigor through which this is being done? And have you designed your trial basically to to kind of rig it for a specific outcome so that you can make marketing claims? Or are you working with real researchers to move science forward? And what is the methodology by which it's being done? Who's your principal investigator? Where is it being published? And are you, you know, is it double blind? Is it randomized and is it placebo controlled?
So just one note on
and
that.
And I would there say it, some- being done in academia, of course, is just another like nice checkbox, but it's not the only, it's not certainly the only way to do
for
it.
For sure, for sure. I do want to add, there are some types of trials that just can't be done double blind, like mm-hmm. certain lifestyle sure. interventions yes. or whatever. It's like you can't yes. hide it from somebody to know what they're doing
or
not doing.
It is true, but there's a lot of other confounding variables in lifestyle intervention. It's why nutrition is, I don't want to say impossible, but it's why nutrition is so challenging to study. It's why you need these like large epidemiological studies. It's why nutrition science is really challenging. you know, and so you're absolutely, you're 100% right. I think there's still a way to go about that with scientific integrity. Like, for you know, sure. if you talk to like, you know, Walter Longo or Suchin Panda, like these are people who are understand, like they're studying nutrition, like, you know, fast mimicking or intermittent fast. Like, you know, these are real scientists working in academia, like who I think have deep understanding and expertise versus like somebody who's coming first from the product perspective and saying, I just want to like get some science so that I can bolster my marketing claims.
So what, for you guys, for the studies that you're doing, what's sort of like the timeline before you see the yeah. results?
I mean, every study is different. Like I think there, I mean.
Oh, the two that you mentioned.
Oh, the two that I mentioned, I think one actually, our Canadian, our antibiotic recovery trial will begin, I would say like in 6 to 9 months is realistic. And then with IBS, I would say it's probably 9 to 12 months is my guess.
And what's your hope after those, you know, studies? Obviously you got to see the results and see how it comes back. What's the hope of what you can do and what you can share with the community or the larger population or academia in terms of what's possible after like a rigorous study like that's done?
I mean, I think we would publish it. I think it's great literature to be able to reference. I think it furthers an understanding of the field. Like a great example is that the antibiotic recovery trial is tech-enabled with, will be the first trial to use like the world's first gas sensor to measure like the gaseous byproducts in the gut at every single stage of the gut that transmits data via Bluetooth to the cloud and to a phone so that you actually like know at every stage. So I would say that unlocks new biomarkers in understanding two things. One, it deepens our understanding of the GI system and the gut and the microbiome because bacteria produce these gases. So it's like a whole new set of biomarkers. Right now we look at stool, which is a very crude, the gut is very hard to reach, which is why the microbiome is just coming online now because it's like incredibly invasive. You can't biopsy everybody's like epithelial, you know, it's like, it's a very hard place to reach. So we've relied mostly on stool and very crude biomarkers. The opportunity, like in that trial specifically, like, yes, it will be of course great if there's positive results, but the reason that we do these things is not to basically start making antibiotic claims, but it actually in this specific trial opens up new biomarkers like gases, the measurement of short chain fatty acids, using this new technology to unlock a whole new way of not just understanding the gut, but also understanding like what does administering a microbe, a probiotic in our case, this particular consortia or formulation of probiotics, what does that do or change in a gut in a heterogeneous population and what in a way that's now measured in a way we've never measured it before? And that even if the trial, like depend, no matter the outcome of the trial, starting to gather that data unlocks our ability to start to say, well, if these microbes do this in this population, what does that mean if we understand, like how could we then apply that to moving science forward in other ways or in other areas of our pipeline?
So I wanted to come back full circle when I was asking you about like, what does seed do and yes. like, what are you guys up to? It's not just these consumer probiotics. There's no. other aspects that you guys are working on. I do want to hit one more kind of consumer venture and then talk about the work that you guys are doing with honeybees. Mm-hmm. So just want to bring it back to Luca.
Yes.
Tell us more about that. And when is that coming out for that whole world of UTI?
Yeah, this is an area where you have to be careful, like what you say to the world, because, you know, the minute we announced Luca Biologics, which is our women's health and vaginal microbiome biotech's been out, the rest, the world of women in my life texted me and they're just like, when can I buy it? And I'm like, you know, I'm like, well, in 3 years, probably.
Realistically, 3 years.
Yeah. Well, and that's probably the fastest timeline. Yeah. And so Luca is interesting because it's our co-founded company with Dr. Jacques Revelle from University of Maryland. He oversaw the vaginal microbiome and women's health kind of research track of the Human Microbiome Project that was initiated by the NIH under the Obama administration. And that is our work really to look at three key areas. The first is urinary tract infection. The second is bacterial vaginosis. And the third is preterm birth, which the latter two, BV and preterm birth, being incredibly important, particularly in the developing world, where BV and preterm birth are a really big problem.
So will that show up as like, what are people eventually going to buy?
Those will be prescription drugs
that will come from a doctor. Yes.
You know, I think I would like to say of course it has to be prescribed by someone who can prescribe. Who prescribes is something that from a regulatory perspective is often changing just because now even nurse practitioners can prescribe. But I think that is one where, and you know, I believe that there'll be, and our certainly our mission is how we can get those out into the world in ways that can make the most impact. And so I imagine there'll be a lot of nonprofit partnerships, and the ability to, not just sell drugs, but, wrap around that whole experience deep education, because like a lot of women really are very lost. Like even the most educated women I know who actually have plenty of income and opportunities to see any doctor really don't understand their bodies or know them. And so I think what you'll see from us in the coming years, even while the drugs are kind of in development or going through phase trials, is an opportunity to use the platform to start to educate and create content and translate science in a way that women can kind of gain a deeper understanding of their bodies and these conditions. So I hope that we, while most, I think, pharma companies just think about like how you pay for the commercial with people romping through the field, I think we are really trying to figure out like how can we use these entities that we spin out also as a means to make impact beyond just the drug. And that's probably through education.
You know, as co-CEOs, and obviously you were talking about the difference of the things that you focus on versus your co-founder focuses on, part of the hat that you're also wearing is like, in addition to all the great science and the partnerships and all the cool research that's out there, very like for real, you have to like raise money, you have to show proof of concept in like marketing. So let's talk about like marketing first, right? One thing that you guys are really great at is you're good at education. Mm-hmm. What have been the ways that you have embraced marketing, which is simply storytelling? Yes. Right. So how have you embraced storytelling to really get traction on the first products that are out there in a way that feels in integrity to seed?
Well, we don't make sensationalized or hyperbolic claims, and we're very adherent to both, you know, like both obviously FDA, but also FTC guidelines around these things. In fact, I think in some ways we go the wholly opposite way. When it came, I'll just use an example, we actually are very bad sometimes at talking about our products. Like if you go on our Instagram, we like rarely talk about them. And even in our emails, I think everything comes from like a really deeply educational place and the belief that like we have a kind of mantra that friction is the future. I think in all the things that have gotten people very slickly through e-com funnels and get them to, you know, how do you get someone to check out, right? Like, how do you get someone quickly through a funnel? I'm not sure that's where you gain long-term value from. I'm not sure that's like where you ultimately like sit in someone's mind share of where do they want to go first to like understand something, and where does authority and credibility come from? Just because you have a slick like e-com funnel, like yes, it posts some nice numbers, but when you start to look at things like in marketing, like LTV CAC ratios, and you look at the long-term value of your customers, like we really take a much longer view of like, how can we serve somebody? Like what I always impress upon my team, we talk about a lot is, someone's not buying the product that shows up at their doorstep from us. That's not the only thing, that's one thing. That can't be the only thing. That's not enough anymore. And I'm not sure actually that's how we serve somebody who is giving us their money and also entrusting us to put something in their body. And I think, you know, there's two major problems with human health I'd be curious what you and Mark think about this. In Melinda Gates's book actually articulates this incredibly well, which is like delivery and compliance. How do you get something to somebody? And how do you ensure that they actually take it? Like two huge, huge problems in the world. You know this probably from, of course, from food and adherence to like a diet. I mean, it's incredible. People who are terminally ill just like forget to take their medication. It's, you know, it really is. So I think we are always thinking from a marketing perspective of how do you serve? We believe that education is our superpower. We think that the teach a human to fish will always be more impactful than just tell them what fish to eat. Not that we don't do that too, but, and so that's our like driving thesis. As an example of that, kind of in our willingness to try and, or I guess like our excitement or hope to inspire or create kind of like what we believe is like a good antidote to a lot of the misinformation that gets peddled on like Instagram and where some of the like most egregious FTC violations happened. As an example, like when we launched our partner marketing for affiliates, we actually launched a university on Instagram. It's called Seed University. Every story highlight is a different module of the course. At the end, you have to take a final exam and you are not able to access your share of sale links with us unless you do two things. You sign a manifesto that is about stewarding the future of accountable influence. You use hashtag ad, hashtag accountable at the beginning, not at the end, and not buried in a sea of hashtags at the bottom of your post, but you must start your post with those two tags. And unless you pass the final exam, you don't have to get your share of sale links. And so that's like at least our first little toe dip into like, how can we be part of stewarding like more integrity in a world that I think is often rightfully so, like dinged for a lot of the, I guess, both misinformation, sensationalism, like hyperbole, correlation that kind of comes like just egregious ongoing FTC violations. And how could we be a part of maybe changing the way that like actually transparency kind of becomes social capital?
Talk to me about the Honeybee Project.
Oh, sure. Well, we have part of our company called Seed Labs, which is really where we look at how we could take applications of bacteria to solve some big problems. As I mentioned before, we're looking at things like in soil and plastics and even space. But our first project was a probiotic for honeybees that is administered in a, what's called a biopaddy, which is actually, and this is a great example of what I was saying before about like what Melinda Gates says about delivery. You know, sometimes it's not that you don't have great science for something, it's that the application of it is like too onerous for someone. Like, so for a farmer to like have to do something new in their already really busy day is like too challenging. So we worked with a medium that honeybee farmers or and beekeepers are already using, which are these like nutrient patties that they use to kind of get honeybees kind of started, the colony started, like in terms of just giving them, they're basically like almost starter nutrients. And so it kind of sits on the top of the hives.
Is it usually like, I've seen some of those starter packs, kind of like often it's like corn syrup and other
stuff. There's some gross, there's definitely some not awesome ingredients in some of them. That kind of looks like a pancake.
Yeah.
And it kind of sits on the top of the hive. So while we did not innovate all of it to start again, because in delivery, it is very hard to get people to like change things at scale. We do administer and we're experimenting also with now just spraying instead of having to administer it through the patty. But the research to date has been done on the biopaddy. And what we really wanted to look at, and Brendan Daisley, who's our seed fellow that runs the project, he's actually a PhD in Dr. Gregor Reed's lab, whom I spoke about before. He wanted to see if the administration of specific strains of probiotics could have an impact in either colony collapse disorder and American foulbrood disease, which actually is not just a problem for more mature bees, but actually is a problem for the actual larvae themselves. And you see a lot of die-off even just at the earliest stage of like honeybee life when you look at American foulbrood disease. So the hypothesis that he started with was that the administration of these microbes, these probiotics, could actually increase a honeybee's immune resistance to neonicotinoid pesticides and then reduce the rate of die-off, which is obviously a huge, huge problem. And so it's working.
And how do you find out if it's working? Is it just sort of?
Brendan just finished. We just published in Nature last week was his, I believe, second publication on it. And obviously he's literally testing in hives.
That's amazing. Yeah. And so honeybee farmers or people that are out there, yes, they can go and buy it.
Yes, we open source like all the IP to anyone who wants to use it. It's pretty manual right now in terms of like getting it to people and all that. But yes, we have a mechanism by which right now
they can like mix their formula.
Yeah, so we just kind of allow them to use it. And
so is it primarily like figuring out which microbes to bring in that support the bees?
Yep.
So people can go and find those things from like a...
Yes. Well, we are actually working right now because we've had such like kind of an overwhelming interest in it of like how we can really now scale it because like now that the research is starting. And actually there was even an increase in honey production, which it was kind of interesting to see too. Now we're in the place where we're like, okay, how are we going to scale that?
That's amazing. And where would people go for more information to like learn about that project?
I think they just email care@seed.com. I believe it's set up as seedlabs@seed.com too. But I will get back to you with the exact email address.
Amazing. We'll pop it in there. Oh, it's been fantastic to go through and talk about just like all the themes of having life experiences, integrating them into wanting to create something, not to only just solve your immediate, you know, scratch your own immediate itch, but also how can you make the world a better place? How can you give back? And you can do it with the right type of rigor and science, find the partners, including scientists and a co-founder that can help you get to that place. So you're just not completely doing it on your own, which we're not really meant to do. We're supposed to build things with other people. And it's been super fascinating conversation. What is for anyone that's thinking about venturing down the pathway, you know, the thing that I've always appreciated, even for the first time that we met at Summit Series and that, is that your background isn't science.
Mm-hmm. No.
There's this deep commitment to the understanding of continuing your education, even if it's not your formal education. You haven't stopped your education that's there. You've surrounded yourself with the right people. And there's a lot of individuals that are listening that they're kind of like professional amateurs, right? They care about science. They want to read. They read the different books of the people that come on the podcast, people that are studying epigenetics or neuroscience or publishing really interesting studies. What's your suggestion or recommendations or tips? Because I think when I see you talk and when I see you give interviews, nobody would know that your background is in science. And it's given you such a level of confidence to be able to come in and create and inspire people with really actionable tips that have the backing that's there. So there's a little bit, this is a long-winded question, but I think I know I think you know what I'm trying to set up is that there can feel like sometimes in a sense of imposter syndrome of wanting to go, at least even go deeper down the pathway of getting more educated if your formal degree is not in that space. You've done it so well. What would you recommend for people who want to go down that same path?
Well, look, I think just being an entrepreneur in general, like you always have this almost like grandiose optimism and like a really beautiful sense of entitlement, not in like the millennial way, but in this way that like the world is out there to be known. And you just have to kind of think about like how you're going to kind of cock your head and like look at it differently. And so I think a lot of that same entrepreneurial spirit that drives like anyone who's like, I don't often like using this word, but it's appropriate here, which is like anyone who's like thinking about disruption, I think it's kind of like creating metaphors or analogies, right? Like you have to deeply understand something to then come in and look at it from an outsider's point of view and figure out how you're going to disrupt it. You know, there's, you know, you look at someone like the Elon Musks of the world or the people who like fundamentally just like think about transportation differently or think. And I think that's actually one of the most beautiful things about being an entrepreneur is that usually you're always looking and you're seeing something that nobody else sees. What I often urge like people who are going into this world is that you have to also think about the accountability. It's very easy to say like, I want to disrupt the $50 billion probiotics industry. It's a very different thing to go out about it. And by the way, there's probably like a cool brand opportunity to like for someone to just like go create a cool brand around that. I think for us and the quicker way is that it's not just similar to the way Tim Ferriss speaks about like mastery, which is, or the 10,000 hour mark that you hear about, which is I have immersion and literally reading and speaking to every, like anyone who's an entrepreneur is always connected. They're always like sitting there, like you can kind of like watch their brain working. It's always like connecting the dots. And I think it is truly like the best deep work and true, like what Peter Thiel refers to, like zero to one happens, not the tinkering that he calls about like a lot of other startups, but like when you really want to take something like literally zero to one something, I don't know if that happens if you aren't like deeply immersing yourself. Like creating a 14 slide keynote deck is not deep immersion. Like that's not deep immersion. I don't feel imposter syndrome. I'm just incredibly transparent about what I fundamentally don't know. I'm also a human that when I don't know something, it also drives me crazy. And so I will spend time going and reading. And, you know, I mean, look, I also get the benefit. Now we have a company where like, if you just sat on our Slack channels, you'd have a PhD in like probably like the next year, just because of like how much information kind of comes in on a daily basis from different inputs. I also think, and this is actually I'm leaving here to go to Good Magazine and Upworthy are hosting a meeting in Malibu today about the translation of science. And so I think so much of like, it's not just about what your business model is and what you're going to do. And you pointed out, like we talked about storytelling this whole time, what are you steward? Like so much of like the way that the best companies, I think, really make an impact is not like, yes, you want to have the products to back it up. You want to have the research, you have the amount of science, but there's a lot of great science out there that just has the worst translation. And we're in a moment where science has become an opinion, which is really dangerous. And as evidenced by, just look at climate change policy as an example, where now like our responsibility as entrepreneurs is that you have to get to a place of deep understanding so that we can be the ones that use these brands and companies to go tell the stories with like the most integrity that is not just about selling our products, but it's about creating deep impact and change, because public perception of these ideas and these things is really like we think that science and like humans are somehow like these different worlds, but there's a great book that talks about like the making of a scientific fact, and it shows you how these cultural contexts and like public opinion shape what gets funding, shape what people will either believe in at scale, shapes how the media then goes and interprets these things, which in turn has a tremendous impact on like whether or not we can make change quickly. And we're seeing that obviously, as I said, with climate change now, but I would just say it is really comes from that deep, deep immersion and that stewardship of wanting to translate or communicate about whatever you're building a business in beyond just selling your products and creating valuation.
Beautiful. So for our guests that want to follow you, Seed, the whole works, check out the Daily Symbiotic, give us the rundown of where they can find it all.
Sure. So our consumer innovations brand Seed is at seed.com. On Instagram, it's at Seed. And our Seed University is at Seed University. And I'm at Eric Katz.
And you're on all the socials and everything like that?
I'm on all the socials, although I've been on a slight hiatus, but kind of brewing and thinking about like if I'm going to take time of my day to communicate there, I need to be thoughtful about what it's going to be. So in January, it will be more exciting. But yes, you can find me on mostly on the Instagram.
And for our audience, if they wanted to go through the university and
anybody
go through
can.
The content, they can.
Go for it. Yes, the only thing that might not feel as relevant is there's a whole section about FTC guidelines.
Right.
But obviously, I actually think is anybody being a consumer should actually read those so that you understand what the people who are promoting things to you are supposed to be doing. And I think that, so it's probably valuable regardless, but it was designed more for people who are the ones doing it.
Make you a more mindful shopper and just know.
Absolutely.
What's out there.
Yep.
Ara, thank you for being on the Broken Brain Podcast. Appreciate you sharing with the audience.
Thank you for all your thoughtful questions. This was so fun. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Just a reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only. This podcast is not, I repeat, it's not a substitute for professional care by a doctor or otherwise qualified medical professional. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute medical or other professional advice or services. If you're looking for help in your journey, seek out a qualified medical practitioner. If you're looking for a functional medicine practitioner, you can visit ifm.org and search their Find a Provider database. It's important that you have somebody in your corner that's qualified, that's trained, that's a licensed healthcare practitioner helping you make changes, especially when it comes to your health.